It's my great privilege to welcome our two speakers for this evening, neither of whom I think require much introduction. Archbishop Rowan Williams taught theology here in Cambridge from 1977 before becoming the Dean of Clare from 1984, after which he served from 1986 as the Lady Margaret Professor of Divinity in Oxford. He then became Archbishop of Wales in 2000, and then Archbishop of Canterbury in 2003. In 2006, the Archbishop, who I have to say is a prolific author, was awarded an honorary doctorate by this university. And on our bookstall, you'll find the Archbishop's recent book, Dostoevsky, Language, Faith, and Fiction. Professor Terry Eagleton is one of this country's best-known literary critics. He currently holds the chair within the Department of English and Creative Writing at Lancaster University. Before that, he was Professor of English Literature at Oxford from 1992 to 2001, and then he was Professor of Cultural Theory at Manchester University until 2008. And of particular relevance to our discussion this evening is his recent book, Reason, Faith, and Revolution, Reflections on the God Debate, which is also on our bookstall this evening, which I hope you'll browse afterwards if you can stay. So let me just say a word about our format for this evening. Note that this is a public discussion, it's not a debate. Professor Eagleton will first give a short talk on political responses to the New Atheism, and that will be followed then by a talk from Archbishop Rowan on theological responses to the New Atheism. We're then going to have some discussion up here between the two speakers for a little while, and we're then going to throw the discussion open to the floor for a general time of questions and interaction, and I'll tell you later on how we're going to do that. So first of all, I'd like to call on Professor Eagleton to speak on political responses to New Atheism, and then the Archbishop will follow on immediately afterwards without further introduction to give his talk on theological responses to the New Atheism. But first of all, Professor Eagleton.
Can you hear me all right at the back? Yes? Is that okay? I thought this was supposed to be the session on extraterrestrial life. Rowan Williams has unwittingly, totally unwittingly, spoiled my opening joke, which was that you might be finding it hard to distinguish between two grey-bearded, grey-haired, middle-aged men, but I'm the one not wearing a skirt. I was even going to wear not wearing a skirt at the moment. The last time I spoke in this church was actually 42 years ago, which those of you who are adept at arithmetic will realise was allegedly the year of 1968, when I debated with the then Dean of Trinity on student militancy. Curiously enough, I was for it and he was against it. But whether you're for it or against it, you're going to see a great deal more of it in the coming months and years, I'm quite sure. Why is everybody suddenly talking about God? I mean, the most unlikely people, maybe including myself. Why have bookshops suddenly sprouted sections called atheism? Why has no less a journal than the Wall Street Journal, circulation I think 20 million, invited Richard Dawkins and myself to write front page articles on God and atheism? I told the editor that I would agree as long as I could insert the sentence, the Wall Street Journal would never have given a column to Jesus. I mean, certainly, when I mentioned Richard Dawkins, I don't know very much about him. The only thing I really know is that his wife used to appear in Doctor Who. Is that right? Very interesting fact. I think he's also some kind of scientist. I mean, why is it that just at the point where it seemed we were all entering upon a post-theological, post-metaphysical, even post-historical age, God is suddenly back centre stage again? You know, I can imagine God having you know, glumly contemplating the sordid course of human history and bitterly regretting that he'd ever created the slightest particle of matter, not least Dick Cheney, looking forward but rather in a rather melancholic vein to a well-earned retirement, and then suddenly, would you believe it, just when all that seemed to be, all of those grand narratives seemed to be over, he's right back in alignment. What is going on here? Why is all of this happening? Well, lots, I should assure, lots of reasons that one could talk about, but I think one could do worse than summarise one of them simply by saying 9/11. I mean, of course, the recent 9/11, not the 9/11 that happened almost to the day 30 years before, when the United States government violently overthrew the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende of Chile and installed in its place an odious dictator who went on to murder far more people than died in the World Trade Center. There was even actually a 9/11 before that, a kind of poor 9/11, which was the birth of Theodore Adorno, but only the right wing has seen that as a catastrophe. Of course, racism had been around a long time before 9/11, and indeed some of the protagonists in the new atheist debate, people like Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, who I believe one commentator has insolently conflated to Ditchkins, even they have been, of course, waiting their various campaigns long before 9/11. But I think that 9/11 brought this whole issue to a new focus of intensity, a new kind of political urgency. What it did, among other things, was to politicise, in a certain sense, the debate about atheism or non-atheism, and not, I think, entirely or largely at all for the good, in my view. Radical Islam, a phenomenon that the West continually forgets, it played a major role in creating, in the middle decades of the 20th century. Radical Islam has, as it were, in part, a very central part, I think, of what has put these questions back on the agenda, but the result has been, I think, very disappointing from the atheist camp. Atheism, of course, is an honourable and ancient doctrine, but at its richest and finest, I think it's very different from this rather sort of off-the-peg enlightenment doctrine that we're now getting, with its rather crassly triumphalistic belief in progress and civility, a sort of return to a scientific rationalism that one had thought was dead, you know, with Herbert Spencer, really.
I was even going to say with Marx and Spencer, but I think that
is too facetious, as they say. And extraordinarily, just at the moment when Western society in its so-called postmodern phase was ditching all of these grand narratives of reason versus barbarism, civilization, the inevitable, inexorable unfolding of progress and so on, just at this moment when all of that was going out of the window, theoretically, suddenly this new urgent global situation has partly resulted in the reinstallment of the very grand narratives that were supposed to have been jettisoned, with now more than a dash, I'm afraid, of cultural supremacism. Moreover, the very liberal literati who were supposed to be the guardians of the flame, of tolerance and inclusiveness and plurality and so on, were disgracefully, I think, among the first to fall into rather panic-stricken postures, bordering upon Islamophobia at times, as it were, the first attack. Indeed, I suppose you can only really be an atheist, a sort of full card-carrying atheist, if you understand what it is you're rejecting, yes? Just as, you know, there's no point in defending the value of synecdoche if you think it's a small town in upper New York State. And I really do sometimes wonder, you know, whether the honorific title of atheist should be bestowed upon men so lamentably ignorant of what it is they seem to be rejecting. Just two quick instances. The whole issue of creation, which Dawkins sees as some sort of pseudo-scientific mumbo-jumbo, whereas, of course, the doctrine of creation, as I understand it, is not about the origin of the world at all. It's nothing to do with that. I mean, Thomas Aquinas devoutly believed in the doctrine of creation, but he thought it perfectly possible that the universe had no origin. It isn't, as far as that goes, you have to be properly atheistic. There's no encroachment of patches here. Secondly, quickly, the issue of belief or faith. The extraordinary assumption by some of these people, including people like Sam Harris in his attack on religion, a book which says that we might have to make preemptive nuclear strikes against certain Muslim nations. And he's a liberal. God knows what the neoconservatives are. That all of these people, including, I'm certainly Dennett, seem to believe that, you know, the grammar of I believe in God is a bit like the grammar of I believe in the Yeti, or I believe that at least some goblins are gay. I hope, only take a first-year theology student to put them right on this crass error. As I understand it, again, Christian faith is about the kind of commitment made by a tortured political criminal at the end of his tether, foundering in atrocious pain and a sense of utter abandonment, who nevertheless somehow remains true, remains loyal to the promise of a transformative love and justice. That's worth arguing about, to be sure, isn't it? Lots of people can argue about that. Lots of atheistic left-wingers these days are very interested in that. That's another aspect of the so-called God debate. But it's nothing to do with the Yeti, I'm afraid. Let me just finish by saying this. Advanced capitalism is an inherently faithless system. I don't say that in some morally denunciation way. I mean, it's just a fact that market societies, certainly of any advanced kind, are inherently materialistic, secular, rationalist, pragmatic, relativistic, and so on. That's just the nature of the beast. Whatever they may piously proclaim, and sometimes there's an embarrassing gap between, as it were, the rhetoric and the reality there. They, in other words, belief is not what is central to such societies. Belief is not what pins them together, as it pins the Lutheran Church or the Flat Earth Society together. Yes. As long as you roll out of bed and work and don't, you know, beat up too many police officers and so on, the liberal state doesn't give a damn about what you believe, as long as it doesn't interfere with the beliefs of others, and as long as it doesn't undermine that whole framework. But in many ways, of course, that's a precious achievement. But it does mean that the world then becomes rapidly divided between, as it were, those who believe too little and those who believe far too much. Fundamentalists of various kinds, and moreover, that those two camps keep pressing each other into an increasing caricature of themselves. One of the problems then that is raised for the West in the face of radical Islam, an ugly kind of, a neutral kind of fundamentalism, is the contradiction, I think, between its chronic need to believe and its incapacity to do so. It's, as it were, its structural incapacity to do so. And let me just end by saying, having just returned from teaching some graduate students at Notre Dame, where I teach every year, One of the signs of this situation is that in a postmodern culture, if that's what we're in, people feel that passionate conviction itself is inherently, or at least incipiently, authoritarian, dogmatic. Yes. I don't know whether they are passionately convinced of that particular case, or whether they think that about it, but that is, of course, a very bad mistake to make, isn't it? To imagine that passionate conviction in itself is insufficiently dogmatic, and nowhere is that greater, more greatly manifested than in the tendency of a certain younger generation, particularly of Americans, to say "like" every 3 seconds. Like is a nicely provisional, tentative, non-absolute kind of word. You know, to say it's 9 o'clock is unpleasantly autocratic
smugly self-assured. It's late, 9 o'clock.
We were actually both around in this church in this city, and I can remember hearing my interlocutor speaking at the Catholic chaplaincy at that time on Catholic Marxism in the good old days. Probably both of those systems looked a little bit different from the way they look now. But that would be a long story, and although we can have a pleasant time going down memory lane later tonight, I'll leave that for now. Dostoevsky's novel, The Idiot, the very tormented and indeterminate hero or anti-hero, Prince Lyofmishkin, is asked at one point whether he believes in God or not, and his reply is very inconclusive. But he says that what troubles him is the atheist always seems to be talking about something else. And what I want to do in this brief introduction is to try and identify what that something else is that atheists seem to be talking about. That is, what do they think it is they're talking about when they're talking about religious belief and practice? Because I don't think it's very much use carrying on with the discussion unless we've clarified a little bit what they think they mean. I want to suggest that there are two things that they think they are talking about, and two ways in which they construe the notion of religious belief and practice. The first is that religion is a kind of strategy, and the second is that they think it's a kind of explanation. Now, to the first, it's a kind of strategy. That has something to do, of course, with the way in which some kinds of what are sometimes called neo-Darwinian views of the role of science and its decisive place in intellectual discussion, some kinds of neo-Darwinianism would really say every intellectual position is a strategy. That is, it's a way of coping with the circumstances you live in. It's about the survival benefits of what you say you believe. It's about what enables you to maximize your chances of getting through a complex and rather threatening world. Now, there may be a trivial sense in which our intellectual systems and responses are strategies of coping. We have to think about the world we're in order to get from one spot to another. But there's obviously a question not just about religious belief, but about many other sorts of belief. If we say all intellectual activity is strategy and no more. That is, these are ways of coping. They have nothing very much to do with truth, because what changes our belief can't be different beliefs about what is true, but only different beliefs about what keeps us going. The second thing, religion as explanation, of course, assumes that religious belief is meant to be an explanation of funny things that happen in the world. And, of course, it's a very bad explanation of funny things that happen in the world, and now we have a lot of much better ways of explaining what happens in the world, so religious belief ought not to be possible. It's a bad explanation, and has been superseded. Now, both of these are ever so slightly complicated by the fact that religious belief doesn't show a great deal of evidence of fading away, even when people shout at it about how bad his explanations are. Therefore, it sounds rather oddly as if religious belief, in spite of being a bad explanation, is rather a good strategy in some people's eyes. So there's a little bit of a tangle to undo there. But without elaborating too much on those points, I want to say a word about why I think both of those are something else from what the religious person is actually talking about. First of all, about strategy. Well, you could say, obviously, in one sense, religious belief is a way of coping. But it's a way of coping in the sense that every statement we make about the world is a means of finding our way around in it, and finding our way around in it without bumping into too many things at once. We learn our way around. We construct mental worlds and imaginative worlds because, you might almost say, of the bruises we have from bumping into things. And that sense of trying to come to terms with what's there, never mind what we'd like to be there, is part of the intellectual effort for most people. So, a strategy, but perhaps only in a rather thin sense. And then, of course, in a lot of religious traditions, you're up against the rather curious element in religious belief and language, which seems to be cutting rather against survival benefits. What about that kind of religious language that says, essentially, the mindset is about openness to gratuity, receptivity to the overflowing pointlessness of things, which is the source of wonder? What about those kinds of religious language that are about risk? Risk undertaken for the sake of truth, because it's worth risking something if this is the case. What about those kinds of religious language that are about coping with darkness or meaninglessness, or even inviting darkness, entering into the night, as some of the writers say, of contemplation? In order not to allow any strategies, any images, or any fantasies to arise between yourself and the truth. I put it in those rather broad terms because a good deal of that could apply not only to Christianity, but also to other traditions, notably to Buddhism. Something is going on here about the need, in order to allow the truth to be there for you, the need to let go of the security of the ego. So, what kind of a strategy are we talking about if that is how some of the more self-aware and more sophisticated exponents and adherents of religious language see it? That's surely an area where there's something else going on. As to explanation, Terry's already said something about this in a sense. There is a very widespread view that the doctrine of creation is an explanation. Just as the explanation of why the kettle is boiling is a mixture of my putting it on 3 minutes ago and the electrical system that keeps it going, so somehow believing in God is believing in somebody throwing a switch and letting the current flow. But explanations are always, of course, things that go on within the system of the world. An explanatory hypothesis is about how one thing leads to another. And of course, in classical theological language, God is not one thing, nor is the universe another. So that you've got one lump of stuff here called the universe, you wonder where it came from, and then you think that this other lump of stuff, or something, threw the switch. As we've been reminded, what the doctrine of creation says, and yes, I would agree as a theologian with what's been said, what the doctrine of creation says is there's a relationship between everything, every set of circumstances, every phenomenon, and what we can only call a fundamental act that sustains it. It's not an explanation, it's more like a location of what we're talking about in another context. You don't need to believe that there was a first moment. All you need to say for the doctrine of creation to work is that what is depends. It's not there simply of its own action. Not an explanation, not a puzzle, a loose end to tie up, but something else. And so, while both of those could be expanded on, I don't have the time I'd like to elaborate, I just want to suggest those are two things about religious language and practice and reflection which seem to be, at the very least, something else, something other than what the atheist is talking about. The religious believer would want to say, I'm not advancing a strategy, because if you believe every intellectual moment is a strategy and no more, then any kind of talk about truth or discovery becomes rather difficult. And in any case, there are aspects of the language of religion that sit rather oddly with talking about survival strategies. And it's not an explanation, because it's not setting itself up as a rival identification of the things that make other things happen. It certainly makes a bold bid for, as I say, locating the universe entirely in relation to an unconditional act of gift or initiative. But that's not one item in a story or one thing among others. To say that atheists have, in the present discussion, wrongly identified what they're talking about doesn't mean that atheism is rubbish, and it doesn't mean that what I've just said is a knockdown reply to what's been said. But I would hope that we can at least begin by clarifying our terms a little bit and asking how the self-description of the religious believer comes into any argument about the validity of religious language, and how we are deeply liable to be misled in this, as in other areas, by, if I may trespass on the other speaker's territory, by a fundamentally political desire to gain power in an argument by defining for somebody else who they really are, which I think is a slightly dangerous precedent.
Setting the discussion going. Professor Eagleton, do you want to respond at all, say anything in response to what you've just been hearing?
No. Do you, right. Archbishop, would you like to say anything? First, a commentary on Tony Eagleton's commentary.
Just a quick word about how religion is seen and why it is that it's come into, as you said, into the public lens. Yes, 9/11. And 9/11, of course, increasingly as part of a revived narrative, which says there is something called religion, which you can spot in all societies, and it's bad for you. This thing called religion, of which there are various market brands, like Islam and Christianity and Buddhism, in all its forms is a bundle of errors, and of toxic errors. And look at the history of religion, and you'll see it's always making things difficult. It's causing wars and so forth. And when you ask, well, what is this thing called religion? What is it that Buddhism and Islam really have in common? If you ask, what is the role of specific religious practices and communities in prompting the great bloody conflicts of history? It looks a little bit less simple, but it's a wonderfully compelling grand narrative. And it does rather let you off any kind of obligation to get inside the sheer difference of different ways of religious practice. And that's another form of the cultural superiority which we've been warned about. Over there are these strange people who do something called religion. And a lot more could be said about it, but there's been some very interesting work by American writers like William Kavanagh about the way in which the telling of the story, let's say, of the wars of religion in the 16th century has been almost completely kidnapped by this sort of language,
Whereas if you look at the particulars, of course it's about economics, and land ownership, royal power and feudal power. It's about ideas, and it's about lots of other things too. And to say this is a war of religion is just essentializing in a way that doesn't help much. But last comment, I've always been very, very struck by a statement in Wittgenstein's recorded conversations about psychology, aesthetics, and religious belief, where he says, one reason we love reading Freud is that, quote, it is charming to destroy prejudice. We are charmed by the idea that we've got hold of the real story. We are the connoscenti. We know what's really going on. We know that this claims to be a set of notions about truth. We know it's actually a survival strategy. And the charm, the seduction of being on the inside track in this way is one of the things which perhaps explains the astonishing eagerness of human beings these days to believe that they are automata. And that when they think they're thinking, they're not. Because we have the thoughts which can explain to you why thinking you're thinking isn't thinking at all. That's charming.
Professor Eagleton, do you want to comment on the thinness of
the Freud wasn't, Wittgenstein wasn't too impressed by Freud because I think he once said, it takes one Viennese to know another. But no, I don't particularly want to, well, I quite like responding to what people raise now.
Good. We'll love to throw it over then to everybody here, and I'd like to explain how we have this open discussion. There's more, I think, than 1,200 people here this evening, so it's not that easy to have an open discussion with 1,200 people. But we're going to try, and so I really ask your help in this. The way we're going to do this, we have a roving mic, just one roving mic for each balcony, so one on one side, one on the other side. And then there's two fixed microphones at the back there. Oh, sorry, there's one, somebody's pointing at the front. There's one at the front and one down here at the back, okay? So, the way we're going to do this is, if you want to ask a question from the balcony, just wave your arm in the air, and Anusha will come to you with a microphone. But keep waving your arm so I can see you, so then we can get the discussion going. If you're down here at the bottom and you want to ask a question or make a point, if you can either come up to the front of this microphone, it's just to the right, my right, on the lectern here, or there's one at the back there. So that's how we're going to do it. And form, please, an orderly little queue, and we're then going to go in strict rotation and do it that way, and hopefully that will work. Now, if you could keep your comments brief, that would be very, very helpful. I know that lots of people here have got fantastic... wonderful long lectures prepared on atheism. Really, this is not the time for that, so if you could keep that. But do make a few brief points, a few sentences if you will, and that's absolutely fine. And then come to the point and make your question, and then we'll ask our speakers. And of course, if you want to address it to one speaker more than the other, that's absolutely fine as well. So we'll go from there, and please just start moving, so that if you want to have a question or want to make a point, please move to these two fixed mics down here. I'm going to start on my left up in the balcony. Is anyone waving their arm? Because you'll have to wave it really high so I can see. If not, we'll move on to the next place. Okay. Any questions from that side, from the balcony? We don't have anybody yet.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment rather than a question.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Yes. I thought that whilst we clearly have seen the rise of something that posits up the new atheism, over the same period, we've seen the counter-term develop, which is faith. Suddenly the faith communities, so self-homogenization of the so-called faith communities is a corresponding phenomenon, it seems to me.
Thank you. Do you want to comment on that, Archbishop Rowan?
A very interesting point indeed, and I think you're absolutely right. It relates a bit to the way I was suggesting that we've got far too used to using the word religion as if it meant, as I said, something of which there are several grand varieties. And in terms of the kind of engagement that
very often we have to have with government about social cohesion and so forth. There has often been, in the last decade or so in government, there's just a series of kind of row on a shelf faiths. They all work much the same, they all have much the same structures. Vicars are, as it were, imams in clerical collars, and imams are vicars in turbans. And the relationship between religious leadership and religious communities is much the same across the board. So everywhere you go, you have to identify the obvious person to deal with, the obvious leadership group. And it does create a lot of chaos and a lot of unhelpful homogenizing. The problem is, of course, that the faith communities, to use the language myself, buy into this very readily. Because often it's their only access to certain kinds of leverage, certain kinds of funding. So we're in a bit of a vicious circle there sometimes.
One of the big mistakes of some of the new atheist circle is to believe, and certainly I think Hitchens and Dawkins are akin in this, is to believe that all faith is blind faith. Extraordinary, what is in fact, you know, theologically, fideism. Most new atheists are fideists without knowing it, or even without having heard of it, because they actually do assume that faith means the suspension of rationality, and therefore is a kind of blind and groping engagement or commitment, which is mostly therefore utterly groundless and self-sustaining. I think it's another of the reasons why it's so difficult to find common ground between these two languages. Because again, I think it's a caricature of what faith is about.
It's another version of the bad explanation point, in a sense, isn't it?
Here are people who are so alien to rational argument, they believe any kind of explanation.
It's also that there's a kind of unholy alliance.
Have I gone off the air? Yeah. There's a kind of unholy alliance between a kind of positivism and a kind of fideism. Either it's a matter of pure, uninterpreted facts, yes, in a technocratic way, or there's something else called faith that has nothing to do with facts, that's absolutely sealed from it. It's kind of dichotomy.
Thank you. Well, we have a question, I think, at the back. If anyone wants to come and use this microphone, please do at the front. But we're going to have a question from the back. Please, sir. Thank you.
Hi. I saw this talk, Baptized This Evening, and the big type was New Atheism, and that's what drew my eye. I'm a card-carrying atheist, put my hand up. I don't feel this has actually been a debate. It's two people who both have been quite critical of what Baptized New Atheism might be. You both come to the defence of a very subtle and nuanced understanding of faith and religion, which is great, but I haven't heard a very strong case for what new atheism really means. I mean, Dawkins' most recent book mentions that he's in dialogue with religious leaders who have a much more subtle and nuanced view of what religion and faith means than most religious people. So you sort of rather acknowledged Dawkins earlier, and actually I think it's a subtler view than you were putting across. So from my point of view, this discussion has been very disappointing because there's not really any argument, you're sort of both agreeing that that people who put themselves forward as atheists are dumb in their sort of views on religion. And I sort of beg to differ. I would say that it's possible to have a very clear understanding of what religion might be in very profound ways and still come to the conclusion that it's not the right answer.
Thank you. Just to clarify, this was billed as a discussion and not a debate. There's a subtle difference. Professor Eagleton, do you want to comment on that?
Yes, I think it's not intended to be a debate. I said from the beginning that the danger of this discussion was that Rowan and I would agree too much. So the disagreements have to come from, I guess, between us and people like yourself. Any kind of atheism which costs something is something that kind of wins my respect. But I live in a society, Ireland, where every intellectual in the country is a card-carrying atheist, almost. And they buy it largely on the cheap, as to say. If you
come from a country which has a horrendous religious, recent religious history of Parliament, then it's very hard to see how any decent, sane, rational person is going to sign on for this.
Yes.
But the only problem with that is that it allows you, as it were, to buy your agnosticism or atheism on the cheap. You don't actually have to fight for it by rejecting a version of religion that actually makes some sense and that has a powerful kind of appeal. And so the speaker who says, well, there are kinds of atheism which do that exactly, that do reject, but know you want to reject, that absolutely wins my respect and endorsement. But I think I think we disagree in that I don't actually think that's what Hitchens and Dawkins are doing.
Just a very brief remark on that, because it won't be wholly surprising to people who come here that I'm on the non-atheist side. I would want to say that, to me, the challenge that atheists can put when serious, when engaging in the way that Kerry's mentioned, would be somewhere in this territory. And this is what I find most difficult to answer, but become clear. First, I think, is the kind of atheist who says, I sort of see why a religious person can make sense of what they're committed to, but I can't see why I should start being committed. And that's a very tough question, simply in human terms. Why should I start? And I may very well say, try it and see. Which, while I think it's possibly the best response you can make, is intellectually a rather iffy one, because it doesn't give you a knockdown argument. I do think that on the whole, people who come into faith from unbelief don't come because they found a knockdown argument, but because they found a kind of policy for living which eventually becomes irresistibly attractive. That's a longer story. The second area, of course, where atheist argument is powerful and strong, is in the challenge to the inner coherence of belief, especially, we have to name it the problem of evil. Does it make sense to hold simultaneously the things that religious believers are thought to hold about the love of God and the chaos of the world? Now, those are serious things. I don't think they can be written off just by saying, oh, you don't understand. But where I'm entirely with my colleague here is I'd rather argue seriously about that sort of thing than try wearily and repeatedly to see off attacks on what practically nobody I know really believes and how it really works.
Okay, move now into another question up front. Andrew Brown from The Guardian.
Well, I only had one. No, I've got
a live. Can we make that mic live, please?
Dennis, can you hear me?
Yes. Okay, you've got a live one. Yes.
Well, I came up with one question. I've got another one I took Rowan's last answer, which is how do you distinguish a policy for living, which is good, from a belief as a strategy, which is apparently bad. But I have one question for everyone on the platform. Do you think that the new atheism has anything to do with science?
Did you want to pick up policy and strategy? Yes, policy and strategy first.
I was taking strategy essentially as those problem-solving skills that get us through critical challenges. This is a way of negotiating the difficulties. The survival point. Policy won't necessarily be about survival. It can be about something that you believe should be consistently followed through whatever the consequences. I'm not sure strategy is the same thing. On the, does it have anything to do with science? Well, this is what's rather baffling, isn't it? It does have a great deal to do in its rhetoric with science. And the more you look at some of the writings of new atheists and neo-Darwinians, or whatever you want to call them, the more there is this passionate, and in that sense rather countercultural, passionate reductionism. It's only this. It all boils down to this. Scientific knowledge is essentially reductive knowledge, and that's the real stuff. So it's as if the scientific discipline were always boiling down questions to more and more basic form, and that's what's really going on. Now, I don't actually think that's science, because the question of reductionism is a very interesting, complex question within the philosophy of science, and the sense in which a biological answer and a chemical answer to a similar set of problems are equally valid answers. That, I think, is something missed in this passionate desire to say, this and this alone is the real story. So I found myself a bit baffled as to how that's supposed to be scientific.
Can we just go back for a moment to... to Rose saying something on the non-atheistic side here. Given that there, of course, have been Jewish, Islamic, Christian, Marxists, and given extreme liberalism of certain Anglicans, I wouldn't be at all surprised to find, you know, an atheistic Archbishop of Canterbury, a religious socialist. Andrew's question. I think that what's at stake here is what I would want to call a certain ideology of science. There are many sciences, many different scientific discourses, many different ways of framing them. Or even one might say a certain politics of science in relation to what I said to begin with. It's very notable, isn't it, that in Dawkins' The God Delusion, there's now a book on the way out called The Oh My God Delusion, which is bound to happen. There is, as far as I remember, there is not a single word that betrays, first of all, the horrors that science has been complicit in producing, or certain kinds of military technology and so on, or the chanciness of the whole enterprise, the provisional hermeneutical nature of science, which is a set of human practices. Instead, we have the old and really very passé, surely, language among scientists of science as a sort of meta-language, a foundational notion of science. As far as I know, many philosophers of science wouldn't subscribe to, wouldn't want to sign on to. And my interest is why this resurgence now of this really rather old style, not so much scientificity as scientific rationalism. You don't have to be a rationalist to be a scientist. So I think that's where Dawkins is limited in Russian.
Just one more thing on that, which is to quote from a philosopher of science, Joseph Margolis, some 20 years ago, in a book called Science Without Unity, saying, all sciences are human sciences. That is, the distinction between human sciences and natural sciences, and therefore the distinction between fuzzy and exact sciences. Actually, when you look at it, is not nearly so simple. All sciences are human sciences. They are all things that human beings do. It doesn't do to forget that.
Thank you. We're going to
We're going to go up now to the balcony. We're going to pick the strict rotation. Has anyone up there got a microphone and waving their arm? Yes, please.
Hi. Don't you think that you're confusing atheism with anti-religious sentiment? All your arguments today have been how people have been, they say, misunderstanding your religious views. Whereas, as someone raised as an Irish Catholic, and I completely disagree with the speaker's view here, in Ireland we can completely separate our atheism, which is where we don't believe in a higher power or a spirit, from our anti-religious belief. There are plenty of atheist people who are supportive of religion and in Ireland, and plenty of strong believers who are very anti-Catholic church. So, I'm talking about a cheap buy-in. In Ireland, it's a lot cheaper buy-in to just be born and raised Catholic and not question it. When do you buy into your faith? But my main point to you is, don't you think you're confusing atheism with anti-religious sentiment?
The
Professor Eagleton, I think this is one
of the... I missed your last sentence, actually.
Is it okay? Okay, so I think the main point there is there seems to be confusion here between atheism and anti-religious sentiment. And I think the questioner is saying we should keep those distinct, and particularly drawing upon the political and cultural context of Ireland to make that point.
I entirely agree with you that a lot of people raise Catholics in Ireland, or indeed raised religiously anywhere, buy it on the cheap. That the whole structure of their faith somehow works against a critical self-reflection. You know? And that typically the progress then is to leap out of that, once one hits the moment of critical self-reflection, to a rejection of it. And I'm sure you're right that there are reason, as much reasoned rejections of religion in Ireland as anywhere else. All I was saying was, I know a lot of intellectuals in Ireland for whom it's simply part of the baggage. It would be almost inconceivable not to have a secular perspective. And the fault of that is not of them, the fault of that is of the church, absolutely. We're failing to present them with a version of Christianity that it cost them anything to turn down.
It's a fair point, of course, that atheism is not necessarily hostility to religion or religious people. But we are, I think, discussing the new atheism. And one of the features which I think we find in common between Sam Harris at Daniel Dennett and Richard Dawkins and so on, is the quite explicit conviction that religious belief should not exist. And in some of Sam Harris's moreover excited pages, religious belief really should not be allowed to exist. And in some of Christopher Hitchens's moreover excited pages, the notion that the great wars of the next generation will be wars between rationality and religion. Now that's the point where I find the new atheism poses some rather different questions from the broader issues of a debate between belief and unbelief.
Mr. Hitchens doesn't say, well, I'm an atheist, but I'm nothing against religion. He says, religion is disgusting. And in a perverse way, I admire that statement. First of all, of some religion it's absolutely true, and secondly, he's not pussyfooting around, as indeed Christopher Hitchens never does. You know, he's not saying, well, you know, a little bit of this or a little bit of that. He has a passionate conviction. Yes. I mean, it just seems to me that his passionate conviction, admirable in many ways, comes from the wrong kind of rationalistic places. That's the quarrel I have.
Okay, we're going to come back now to this balcony on this side. Can you wave around if you have any question up there? If not, we'll go back to the floor. I can't see everybody, so nobody's up there. They are up there, but not too. Right, we're going to come back to the floor. Please, sir, down here. Thank you.
Yes.
Yes,
sir. One brief question for Mr. Eagleton, please. Do you find intelligent atheism as respectable as intelligent theism? And if not, why? And may I raise a second question for the Archbishop while I'm at it? A very brief one.
Yes.
Yes,
please.
Yes, Archbishop, this concerns the relation between what has been called science and theology. Well, in ages by gone, theology was understood, and I would ask for some comments from you, please. In ages by gone, theology was understood, in fact, as science. Yes? And so some, of course, some more thoughtful thinkers, philosophers, and not one of the recent past, have argued at length that the split between theology, as if it were not based on evidence, and science, as if it had some sort of exclusive revelation from evidence, yes, is in fact misguided. Which is more, one might think very briefly, yes, which is more, I've heard the word rationalism as associated quasi-exclusively, by default, with atheism. There was a Grimond of rationalism, of course, and Thomas Aquinas. I mean, there is a rationalist tradition, Platonic, Aristotelian. Perhaps you would like to comment on that. Thank you very much.
Yes, sorry, please. I mean, the Enlightenment, for example, is much more complex and interesting in that respect, and I think its supposed modern-day avatars know. I mean, forms of religious rationalism, for example, the coming together of religious and rationalist currents, rather than a simplistic sort of simple opposition. As to your point about intelligent atheism and intelligent theism, I actually don't really like either of them very much. I'm about to unveil an exciting third position, you know, whether there is a God or there isn't a God. Yeah. No, because it seems to me that the whole idea of theism, which has, of course, an extraordinary interest in history, not least in the Enlightenment, has smacks of the sort of, do you believe in an extraterrestrial object notion of God? And some atheism, of course, makes the same mistake. That is to say, to that extent, they're in cahoots. They take different positions, one's positive and one's negative about it, but they essentially share the notion that to say you have faith in God is to say, is there an extra invisible object in the universe? Yes or no? And I think that's not the way of approaching the question.
On the relation of science and theology and on rationalism, theology certainly described itself as a science in the Middle Ages. But of course what that meant was not precisely what the 19th century and afterwards meant by a science. People in the Middle Ages who used that language meant theology is not just a series of impressionistic ramblings. Theology has some structure, it has a text that it works on, and its job is to make a coherent sense of that text. The text is primarily scripture. It's also the practice of the church, and theology is an orderly way of thinking about that. I think that's what St. Thomas Aquinas is after at the very beginning of his great Summa. So certainly theology historically doesn't set itself up as anti-scientific or anti-order or anti-reason, but the way in which it approaches it is not what the modern terms suggest to us. Same really with reason. There's a vastly complex theology of reason in the pre-modern period, which on the whole means the human capacity to get in tune with the way things are. So reason, if you like, includes meditation as much as argument. Now, by the time you get to the Enlightenment, you do indeed have a very complicated story. Reason suddenly means a lot of very different things. Some of them remarkably optimistic and universalistic. Isaiah Berlin's great essay on liberty makes the point that the mainstream of Enlightenment nationalism said there are principles and arguments which are accessible to everybody. When you know those, you can solve all the problems you can come across. And the problem is, as Berlin remarked, take that on a few stages further, and you get to the point of saying, so everybody who disagrees with this must be mad. That way lies some very murky social practice. So we probably need to rediscover a more nuanced sense of reason. I think that we need to talk more about our modes of reasoning, even if it's, to refer a bit of a cliche, the different ways the different modes of the brain work in reasoning, rather than looking for, again, an essential reason, which is the same for everybody, which produces exactly the same results all the time.
Thank you. We're going to have one more question from the floor here. Please. Yes. I think there's somebody in line or not? Yes. With the red shirt? Yeah. Yep.
Yes, speak right.
Speak right into the microphone. Thank you.
I haven't really had enough time to read up on this discussion before I turn up yet. So what I'd like to ask is, by the new atheism, do you mean atheism as it's become the last, really in my lifespan, a series of very aggressive anti-religion, anti-belief system, anti-any concept that there is a God, rather than atheism in the sense of
I do not acknowledge the existence of the God. That anti-religious rather than non-religious stuff.
Basically, yes, I think. But the word the New Atheism has, the words the New Atheism have been used generally to talk about the very powerful and sustained polemic of people like Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett in the last decade or decade and a half. And I guess if you scroll back 30 years or so, 30 or 40 years, you'd find plenty of arguments between believers and unbelievers of a fairly dense intellectual kind. Things exchanged between Freddie Ayer and Father Copleston, a Jesuit, for example, or the work of Bertrand Russell. Yeah. What I think is different is the sense of this having now become, as Terry was saying, a matter of political urgency for some people. It is now so obvious that religion is so bad for us that we must give no quarter. Side, which I think that's the political side.
It's a militant atheism, isn't it? That's, there are plenty of non-militant forms of atheism, but what interests me is why this as Ron was saying, this new term of urgency. Why at this particular historical point does one get a kind of repetition of some of the more militant atheisms?
Okay, well, we'll come now up to the balcony here, in case anybody has a question. Please, yes, I can see you. Thank you.
Hello, yes. I think the panel tonight has been guilty of keeping things incredibly vague, and therefore not really presenting any sort of target. We have heard about God, which is a start, but we haven't heard any mention about Jesus, or the Bible, or the Christian creeds. And it's almost as if... New atheists are obliged to justify everything they say, but the religious side doesn't even begin to justify their beliefs and their sides of the argument. And I think what it is that new atheists really object to, it's not an abstract argument about the nature of God. They object to the aspects of religion which are clearly very harmful for human flourishing. And you, Archbishop, will doubtless be brought down to earth either next week or the week after when you attend your next crisis meeting among gay bishops or women bishops, the sort of things we haven't heard about tonight. And of course, this all reflects ancient prejudices against gay people and women. And I could talk about things like, you know, other doctrines such as the afterlife, which do really useful work for the jihadist bombers and so forth. But we haven't heard about any of these things. They haven't even been mentioned, never mind even justified. And so if you're going to keep everything so vague and just talk about an abstract God and we're not even sure what that means, well, you win.
Some of those things... In some of those respects in which religious practice is manifestly bad for people, of the kind you've mentioned, are of course attacked by religious believers themselves as well as by unbelievers, which is one reason why I would be a bit reluctant to say if you're religious, you're automatically associated with the following set of prejudices. And because that's a fact, and you know, if it weren't a fact, I'd have a lot easier a time in the synod. The other thing is, I suspect you may still be working with you today with that notion of religion as something which you can actually describe in the abstract, a set of beliefs about the afterlife, etc., rather than the very considerable local historical variety of what religious people have said and done. It's because religious practice and language includes a lot of internal argument, precisely about some of those aspects you touch on, where it has cruel or dehumanising effects, that I think it's possible to push back a little and say, well, it can't be as simple as some of its critics say. Sorry, that's a short answer to a very large question, I know. I would just add, though, that one of those things which religious belief and practice contribute to the overall moral and social agenda and fabric we're in is a powerfully non-negotiable sense of human dignity. There is something about the human person that is inviolable in its dignity. It's part of what very slowly, painfully slowly, has actually led religious traditions to criticize their own attitudes to slavery or to women or whatever, because that edgy sense of something that cannot just be overridden or made unfashionable keeps that going. It's not a pretty history, but it is a history. It's moved.
I think some religion, as I said before, some religion is extremely bad for you, like salt or smoking. And that's where I admire what Hitchens and Dawkins and other people say about some of the most noxious institutional effects of religion, how it's blighted and maimed so many human lives. But if religion means texts and evangelicalism on the one hand, it also means liberation theology on the other. But I don't think liberation theology was harmful to America. I think it needed a lot more of it. As far as the concern about, you say, people have thought about God but not about Jesus and so on. Well, I think one of the problems with the new atheism is exactly that. That they begin from this conception of religion, which is, you know, how much scientific evidence is there for the existence of God? Well, that may be a reasonable question, but when I talked about faith, if you remember in my opening remarks, I said that it's, you know, what does one make of a tortured political criminal at the end of his tether and so on? It seems to me that the mistake, one of the many mistakes of the New Atheism, is not to centre the arguments there. But the question of faith seems to me, again, speaking largely as an outsider, what is it one makes of this? Not abstract arguments about a supreme being.
Okay,
we're running low on time now. We've got time for one very quick question, which is going to be from the floor. I'm sorry for the queue of people there, but first question in the queue. Please can you keep your question short? Thank you very much.
We talked about its variety. Is religion such a confusing and nebulous concept that it actually doesn't work? And how good is religion as a category?
I think increasingly religion is a rather unhelpful term because of this sense that you've got something called religion of which there are then a number of market brands. We have to have something, I suppose, which holds together all those varied practices which purport to relate to the way things really are and to bring transformation or enlightenment. Religion is a term that sort of works in that context, but we have to be very wary of it. But then I suppose when you think of a lot of other terms we fling around with merry abandon like literature, we may have some of the same problems.
I think I'm right in saying, I'm not sure, I think I'm right in saying that religion has a term, as it were, an anthropological or sociological term, as Rowan says, to describe various kinds of practices and institutions, really only comes into its own in the early modern period.
18th century.
18th century, in fact, Enlightenment period. Before that, I think the term is much more fake, because the medieval term is much more fake. And to that extent, the word religion is already, as it were, a implicitly secularizing word. It already decides to look at these practices, as it were, on all fours with other kinds of social institutions, which in turn reflects the way in which they have in reality been increasingly integrated into those institutions rather than operating as a kind of critique of them. So the history of the word religion itself, I think, is not innocent.
Okay, well, I think we're sadly running out of time. This is a discussion that could run and run. And let me emphasize again that it is a discussion we've been having this evening. We didn't want to have a great sort of debate with votes and all that kind of thing. That That's not what this has been about, and I'm sure you realise that as we've gone along. We're hoping that many will want to stay and carry on chatting and discussing and have a drink. There'll be drinks of wine or soft drink brought around if you just want to stay in your place for a moment. They will come if you're patient. Some we know will have to go. Don't please forget the bookstall. There are books by both our speakers on the bookstall at the back this evening. But last but not least, let us thank our speakers very much indeed.